CYC podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. In the May 2016 podcast, I spoke with Star about their time doing sex work. I left that conversation with many questions and wanted to speak more about this topic, particularly as it relates to people under the legal age of consent. In North America, an often quoted statistic is that the average age of people beginning sex work is 15 years old. Today, I'm speaking with Nikki Thomas. Nikki is a sex worker and has been involved in the business for about a decade. She's a strong advocate for rights of sex workers and was involved in a recent case that went to the Supreme Court of Canada, a case that resulted in forcing the government to change the laws regarding sex work. Nikki also hosts Allegra Escorts Collective podcasts, where she speaks with other sex workers. I'm a fan and regular listener of the podcast. If you want to hear more from Nikki, I'll post a link to the podcast from the CYC podcast website. Hello, Nikki, and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Wolfgang. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Thank you. Could you introduce yourself and explain a little bit about why you're joining us to talk about non-adult sex work today?
Yes, of course. Well, as you mentioned, I've been involved in the sex industry for about a decade, and contrary to many of the myths that surround sex workers and when they begin, I actually started when I was 27 years old. 26 and a half, but who's counting? I had gone back to school in order to receive another degree after spending a number of years in rather unfulfilling sales jobs, and found that I needed some sort of career or some sort of job that would pay my living expenses and my tuition while still giving me enough time to study. And I had a friend who was a dancer at a strip club that was not too far from where I lived. So I asked her a little bit about it, and she told me that it was pretty good money and the hours seemed to work with my class schedule. And I had always been rather open-minded when it came to issues of sex and sexuality, so I decided to give it a chance. And I remember very distinctly the very first time that I was dancing on stage, having this flash in my mind where I was thinking, wait a minute, isn't this the moment when I'm supposed to feel degraded or dehumanized? And it never came. I enjoyed the attention. I enjoyed the interaction with the customers. I enjoyed providing entertainment in the more private areas. And because of that, I found that private entertainment as an escort was actually much better suited to my attitude and my interactions with people than dancing on stage. And it wasn't long until I started seeing people privately out of my own home. And within a year, I was working full-time as an escort while doing my degree at the same time. And it worked out quite well for me.
I'm so intrigued with that moment when you're on stage thinking, wait a second, this is the moment when I'm supposed to feel horrible. Mm-hmm. And that moment never came for you.
Never came. I actually felt empowered by it. I felt that it was a way for me to tap into a sexual energy that I had felt that society told me I had to repress for many years prior. Mm. And I actually felt freer at that moment than I ever had before.
Do you think it's a common experience for people who start sex work in their mid to late 20s?
I'd say that it's definitely more common for those who start a little bit later. Mm. I mean, one of the reasons why I got into advocacy was because I found that all of those stereotypes and all of those expectations and everything that I had been taught about sex work wasn't true. And I found that both through my own experience and from speaking to other people who were involved in the business. And that statistic that you cited at the very beginning, you know, the average age of entry is 15, or the myth that the average age of entry is actually 13 or 14 or whatever nonsense the prohibitionists, as we like to call them, come up with, is actually not the least bit true. The statistic comes from a study that specifically drew from a population of people who had started sex work when they were under the age of consent. And for those who began sex work before the age of 16 or 18, the average age of entry was indeed 15. But from the overall population of sex workers, most studies find that the average age is closer to 19, 20, or in some cases 23. And it makes perfect sense when you think about it, because if I started at 26, there's no way that there would be 12 people under the age of 15 who had started at 14 or 13 in order to make the average age 15, when you have so many other people like myself who had started in their 20s or in some cases 30s.
There's a couple things there that I want to explore. The first one, though, is you use the term, as I used in the introduction, about non-adult sex work. Mm-hmm. Why do you use that term as opposed to underage sex work, as opposed to child prostitution as opposed to any of the other terms that are...
Well, all those terms that you mention are loaded with emotional power, and they are used very much to evoke imagery of a very, very young child being exploited, as opposed to the term non-adult sex work, which really just refers to the person's legal status as not being an adult. And different societies and different cultures and different governments and different legal structures have different ages of what they view to be consent. So one of the things now that you are seeing very common is that someone is allowed to date a person of a certain age, but is not allowed to sext with that very same person, because the law surrounding what is considered adult sexual imagery versus non-adult sexual imagery are blurred with the age of consent. And I view sex work very much along the same continuum, insofar as somebody's age of legal consent is not necessarily equivalent to their age of agency or personal choice or personal freedom. So I use the term to remind everyone that adulthood is not so much a psychological age that one achieves, but some much more a legal status that one is conferred upon the day that they have reached 18 years since they were born.
You bring up the idea of agency and choice. And certainly much of the discussion around non-adult sex workers is that it's not their choice. They're forced into it. Or if it is, you know, if they say it's their choice, they don't, it's not really their choice. Could we talk a little bit about agency, and can someone who's 14 or 15 or 13, do you really believe that there's agency for that person to willingly engage in sex for money?
Well, when we talk about agency and choice in any sort of capitalist system, we're always talking about it within a range of options. And I know that this is the type of wishy-washy answer that sometimes prohibitionists will seize upon, but it's true. And I would be remiss if I didn't recognize that choice means different things to different people. And sometimes choice is simply taking the least bad option amongst several bad options. So I myself did not engage in any sort of non-adult sex work throughout my life. I did not have those experiences. I was not put in a position of extreme need to the point where that was something that I considered before I was above the age of majority. But I know several people who have, and I have had conversations with other sex workers who did begin their sex work career prior to the age of majority. And I used to have the same sort of stereotypical viewpoint of it as everybody else. And I used to think that it was inherently exploitative and absolutely horrible to begin engaging in sex work at such a young age. And indeed, it's not something that I would recommend to anybody who's under the age of 18. I like to say even that 21 is a pretty good age to start thinking about it, because at that point, your neurological development has reached a certain point. And hopefully your sexual maturity has reached a certain point as well. And one phrase that I do like to put out there is that it's usually better to learn how to have sex for fun before you learn how to have sex for money, because the two things are very different. And if there is one thing that my nearly 10 years in sex work has taught me, is that you have to be able to separate the sex you have for fun from the sex that you have for money, because when those two start to blur, you get into dangerous area. But I digress. One story which I had been told, which was very, very vivid, was from a young lady who's now in her late 20s, who told me how she had started when she was 14, and she told me the circumstances surrounding it. And she had come from a very, very abusive home, and she had tried running away from home in the past, but was unable to support herself in any way, shape, or form, and had been sent back to her home and sent back to that same very abuse because of a children's aid society that thought that they were rescuing her from an inherently dangerous situation without recognizing just how dangerous her situation was at home. And she told me later that when she was away from home, she had been with a man in his late 50s who was very kind to her and very, very supportive of her, and wanted her to continue going to school and gave her shelter and gave her an allowance, and yes, did expect some sort of sexual compensation for that. And just like everybody hearing this right now, my stomach turned when I first heard that, and I thought to myself, what a horrible exploitative situation, and what a terrible man he was. And I'm not here to speak well of him in particular, but the way that she told it was that he had shown her more kindness and caring than any adult in her life had previously. And that really struck me as being a recognition that sometimes someone is has a choice between what might be perceived as a bad situation versus something that is certainly a worse situation. And when Children's Aid intervened and sent her home, I have to say, Daddy's little girl was not very happy to be back there. And her father was incredibly abusive to her until she was finally able to leave when she had turned 16 and finally left the household for good. And she tells me that she will never, ever forgive the system and the people involved in the system who sent her back to that.
The story, you know, I have, you know, goosebumps as you tell that story, and you know, it's for me, and the word I'm going to use is, you know, sort of horrific around the story, and her seeing that those were her only two choices. My you know, child and youth care working self would like to say, but those aren't the only two choices, right? We have a whole residential care system that it's not, you know, either you're going to be sexually abused by your father or you're going to be, you know, sexually exploited by this 50-year-old man. We have group homes, we have foster care, we have all these other systems. Why are those not a viable or a better option in that case? I know you don't know all the details of that case probably, but or that person's life.
And I wish that we did have a social support network that did make sure that people like her did not fall through the cracks. And I wish to have been able to suggest those options to her. And I wish that they were able to deliver. But the absolute reality is that no system is perfect. And sometimes people are unable to access the supports of those systems. And we know certainly that they are underfunded and overstressed and not nearly capable of handling all those difficult type situations. And she took it upon herself to handle her own very difficult and very painful situation in the best way that she could. And at the time, that was what she perceived to be the best situation available. And I could not sit there and look her in the face and tell her that she was wrong for it. I could not look her in the eye and say, you made a bad decision, because she was very, very intelligent, and she was very well spoken, and she was very competent in knowing what her life was like at that time. And I have no doubt in my mind that she felt that it was a better situation. And, you know, if there was an alternative that was better, I wish that I had been able to point her to it, but I couldn't. I was at a loss for words.
For me, this raises you know, perhaps the, you know, the fundamental question in our conversation, which is, what do social service providers who work in the child welfare or the youth justice or youth work system do in those situations? How, you know, so for example, there's a, yeah, so how would a child and youth care practitioner support a young person that they know is doing underage sex work or non-adult sex work, sorry?
Well, part of the reason why I did want to talk about this on your podcast is because I had an experience in a Northern Ontario city a few months back where I spoke to an entire room full of social service workers and people who were frontline workers in dealing with those who had been in precarious situations and those whose lives had been sort of turned upside down. And my entire presentation was around sex work and supporting sex workers. And I was simply, I was shocked at how many of them had never heard the narrative of choice involved whatsoever. And they did not even comprehend of a world in which someone could actively choose to engage in sex work, because their entire experience was dealing with people who had chosen it from a complete dearth of options. And one thing that women do have in society is something that I refer to as erotic capital. And it's the ability to use one's erotic capacity in order to receive other forms of capital. So in some cases, it would be money. In some cases, it would be shelter. In some cases, it would be consideration. In some cases, it would be a piece of jewelry from one's husband. I mean, this is something that is pervasive across all levels of society, and we would be foolish to assume that there isn't something comparable to sex work happening at even the uppermost classes of our capitalist system, right? So I think that that's something that needs to be understood if we're going to understand the choices that some people make at lower levels of class as well, as much as I hate using the term. So if somebody is in a position where their only choice is starvation or sex work, they're more likely to choose sex work than otherwise. And it doesn't do a social service worker any good to view sex work as being the problem in itself. In some cases, sex work is a symptom of a larger problem because it's something that somebody isn't necessarily choosing from a wide range of options. And if you give them another reasonable option, they may choose it. But reasonable means different things to different people. I have 3 degrees from the University of Toronto, and I still find that sex work right now, when I'm 35 years old, fits my schedule perfectly, provides me with a more than reasonable income, allows me to realize a lot of the dreams that I had set out for myself, and enjoy the company of some really wonderful people who I've gotten to know. And I'm very happy in my position, and there are very few options that I can see being presented to me that I would consider preferable than sex work. So choice, again, is something that always comes within context. And as a support worker, or specifically a child and youth worker, it would be absolutely critical to recognize that sex work might be a perfectly viable option for that person at that point in their life. And most importantly, I think a child and youth worker would have to meet that person where they're at and recognize that what they're doing is something that has some value and might very well be a way of them avoiding other problems or avoiding other complications that might be far worse than the sex work itself. Most importantly, if the person does exhibit a desire to move beyond sex work, they cannot make the exiting from the sex industry conditional upon receiving further support. And that is one thing that I have heard other child and youth workers do, which is absolutely disastrous, because entering and exiting and entering sex work again is something that is actually very common for a lot of people. They will get to a point in their life where things seem to be a little bit more stable and they find themselves with a different type of job, perhaps in retail or in food service or something like that, that seems to be doing okay for them at that time. And then something else happens and all of a sudden they find themselves seeing sex work as being an option once again, but they're afraid to tell their child and youth worker that they're doing it because the child and youth worker they've dealt with has demonized the work so much. And at that point, the child and youth worker has lost the trust of their client. And at that point, they cannot really help them any further. So that's one thing I would absolutely caution against.
So let's suppose, and this has happened to me many, many times over the years working with young people, is I develop a relationship with the young person, I get to know them, and then it comes out that they're doing sex work. That you know, I know that they're under the age of 18. Let's make it a little bit easier. Say they're between 16 and 18 because they're no longer part of the child welfare system at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Why should I not call the police, as an example, because this person is, they're in danger potentially, you know, they're breaking the law, always, but all sex work, actually sex work isn't breaking the law in Canada, but it gets, you know, quite murky there. You know, but there's a whole variety of issues that come up. Why, as a CYC or a youth worker or a social worker, should I not call the police?
Well, I don't know the laws surrounding what a CYC worker would be required to do in that type of situation. So I do not want this to be considered any sort of legal advice, nor do I want to in any way seem like I am advising somebody to break the law if the laws in that jurisdiction require them to report this type of activity. But I do not personally feel that the criminal justice system is any friend of any sex worker, nor do I feel that the criminal justice system is going to be especially kind to those in that particular non-adult sex workers' life who may be supporting them in valuable ways. Now, the laws around supporting someone who is not a non-adult sex worker could sometimes be used to prosecute very young adults who are 18, who might be working with those who are 17 or 16, and providing them with material support, or shall we say material benefit, that actually keeps them safe. So something like we see all the time now, where three sex workers are working together and one is under the age of 18, and the other two end up being brought in on what is tantamount to exploitation or pimping charges, even though what they're doing is no different than what three fully adult sex workers might be doing to keep ourselves safe. That would be something where the criminal justice system can do so much more harm than good, because it can actually remove some of the support structures that are keeping that youth out of a far more exploitative situation, keeping that youth out of a situation with a genuine exploitative pimp, somebody who is much, much older and is taking all of their income and forcing them to remain in situations that are very, very unsafe, potentially subjecting them to violence. The last thing that you want to do is isolate somebody who is already involved in sex work any further, because Lord knows it's a highly stigmatized profession to begin with. Lord knows there's a lot of internalized stigma. And if a sex worker who is engaging in non-adult sex work has already trusted the child and youth worker enough to disclose their involvement in sex work, that's a big deal. And the last thing that you want to do is undermine that trust by going to the authorities under the guise of potentially helping them, or falling prey to the rescue myth that is so very prevalent amongst child and youth workers, and think that you're going to be sending them back to a better situation when you know full well that you could be sending them to a worse situation, or forcing them into a situation that is genuinely and completely exploitative.
There was a report that came out in Ontario last week or 2 weeks ago, a review of residential care here in the province of Ontario. And one of the things that it said in the report is that there has been there's a perception of an increase in people in residential care being recruited by other young people. And you started to allude to this, that there's young people in the group home who are doing sex work who are then recruiting other residents of the group home or of the shelter, et cetera, into sex work. And the report suggests that there needs to be a mechanism to deal with this. Any thoughts on how to address this issue in residential care? If some people you think they might be doing sex work, or if you think that some people are being recruited into sex work?
That's a tricky one, because I'm not really privy to all the ins and outs of the system, and I wouldn't want to sound like I'm offering advice when I don't have the knowledge base to really talk about what can be done or what should be done. I do think that providing youth in general with a number of financial supports would probably preclude the need for that. And if we did have a government that was more eager to fund those types of programs and provide those supports and other types of job training and things like that, so that poverty was not something that these youth were staring right in the face, then it may have some sort of mitigating effect against that sort of recruitment. I think that there's a number of different ways of looking at that, and I don't think that in most cases the idea of recruitment is something that's inherently malicious. I think that more likely it would be a youth who is engaged in some sort of sex work and found it to be very financially viable and financially lucrative, sharing the fact that she or they or he are engaging in sex work with one of their peers who then found it interesting and thought about doing it themselves. And then the originator of the idea ends up providing them with contacts who can make it a more safe environment. And again, I don't know if the criminal justice system is really equipped to deal with those types of situations. I mean, in an ideal world where everybody had access to finances and did not have to deal with poverty, then we would have a much more wide range of choices. Like I've said before, I would probably still choose sex work in that type of environment because it's something that suits me quite well. But I always believe that sex work is something that's best done by those who genuinely enjoy it and those who have the most amount of agency and personal choice out of anybody else. And I do not necessarily think that youth generally have that, especially if they're coming out of the type of system that you're talking about, and if they're coming from the residential system that you're discussing. I don't think that agency is something that's necessarily prevalent in those types of situations. So I think that it would be on us as a society to better the conditions of those who are already dealing with a number of intersecting oppressions before we can even get into the policy and before we can get into the actual specifics in terms of how to prevent exploitative recruitment from occurring in the first place.
You've done a lovely job of helping me sort of think through some of these conversations, and you've been very generous with your time, and we had a previous conversation to prepare for this conversation, and I went away and I reflected a lot, and I'm not sure that I'm comfortable leaving this conversation, comfortable saying, oh, okay, I'm going to, you know, support all, you know, 15, 16 year olds who are doing sex work. I, you know, there's lots of feelings that still come up, you know, around, you know, I enter this field to help people, and I worry, you know, that, you know, you have a story of choice, and I'm, some young people I've come across with, you know, don't have that story of choice, and that young 14-year-old, the choice is, you know, it's you know, in ethics we say it's a wrong versus wrong choice, right? Neither one of those are ideal. Is there anything else that you want to touch on, anything that's important and relevant for us before we wrap up this conversation?
Again? Certainly, and I do want to underscore the fact that I too struggle with a lot of those questions around ethics and what would be best and what would be less good for a person. And I mean, I cannot say with absolute certainty that if, you know, I had a child who was 14 or 15 and I found out that they were engaging in non-adult sex work, that I wouldn't be very, very concerned. But again, as long as we're talking along the lines of ethics, I think it's important to recognize what approach can we take that would have the least harmful effect on those that we care about. And I cannot think of any situation in which criminalizing that behavior helps those who are engaging in it. I cannot think of any situation in which having the person arrested or having their support system removed from them because of laws is going to help that person. So even those who are in the most marginalized position with the least agency and the least choice do not benefit from any sort of criminalization. And that goes for criminalization of both the worker and of the client, because study after study is showing that this nonsensical Nordic experiment, I won't even dignify it by calling it a model because it's not a model that anyone should try and replicate. It's an experiment and it's a failure. Criminalization, excuse me, of the client has not in any way made life safer for sex workers, period. Under no circumstances is criminalizing the clients of either adult or non-adult sex workers going to help those who are engaged in it, especially the most marginalized. So I think we need to keep that in mind. And I think it's actually okay if we say to ourselves, you know what? I don't feel comfortable with this. I don't feel like this is a great choice. But I don't think that that even matters. I don't think it should play into any child and youth worker's opinion on decision on what they should do. One's personal opinion about whether or not sex work is a good or bad choice is completely irrelevant to whether or not you need to help that child and youth or that child or that non-adult sex worker engage in that behavior and how best to help them. And all I can say is meet them where they're at. And talk to them like they are making a choice that they feel is best for them at that time, and tell them that you will support them with whatever they need to get their life on track. And if that involves leaving sex work behind and never going back to it, then you will be there for them. If that involves leaving sex work and coming back to it and then getting out of it again and then coming back to it until things finally stabilize, you will be there for them. And you will give them the support and the respect necessary for them to make the best choices for themselves in the lives that they are living then. And at that point, you can help them because you know that they will trust you and they will come to you with the really bad things that are happening when they're happening. And at least at that point, you can meet them head on and say, okay, I'm here for you. Let's solve this problem together.
That's beautifully said. That's really beautifully said. Thank you so, so much for taking the time.
You're very welcome. And thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm really glad that I get to speak to a different audience who are going to be in a position to help those people who absolutely will require support. And hopefully they will be willing to leave their personal judgments at home and just focus on the people that need their help.
Yes. From one service worker to another service worker, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.